Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Larry Hogan is a rare species in American politics, a popular Republican governor of an overwhelmingly Democratic state, Maryland, who regularly bucks Republican Party orthodoxy in the age of Trump. Maybe he comes by it naturally. His father, Larry Sr., was the first Republican on the House Judiciary Committee to announce his support for the impeachment of President Richard Nixon in 1974. I spoke with Governor Hogan recently about all of this, his battle with cancer and other stories from his new memoir, Still Standing. Here's that conversation. Governor Larry Hogan, so good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
There's so much to talk about that's going on right now, both that involve both your role as a leader of the governors and as governor of Maryland. But before we get to that, you have a great story. You just wrote a book called Still Standing, and it's an apt title because you've faced a bunch of challenges in your life. But first, just a little history. Your great-grandparents on both sides came over from Ireland, so you're a classic immigrant story here.
Yeah, I think like so many people in America, we got that background. And, you know, I say I'm 100% Irish. It's probably why I drink beer and eat potatoes so often, why I look the way I do. But, you know, I'm very
proud. I'd be the last to criticize, Governor.
but I'm very proud of my heritage. And, I heard a lot of stories from my grandparents, but on both sides of the family, very Irish, typical Irish Catholic family.
And your folks... You folks went to school together. I assume Catholic schools in Washington.
Yeah, it was two separate. It was an all boys Catholic high school. My dad went to, and kind of the sister school. My mom went to a Catholic girls' school in Washington D.C. But they were high school sweethearts, and then my dad went on to.
Can separate the boys and girls, but they find each other, don't they?
They find each other anyway. Yeah. Exactly.
And and your dad was they both worked so that he could go to college and then on to law school at Georgetown.
Yeah, that happened a lot back then. They didn't have any money, and he was the first in his family to go to college and go through law school. But they both worked, you know, multiple jobs to try to be able to afford to do that. And he got a great education. I learned, you know, so much from both of my parents, and they had a huge impact on my life. I talk a little bit about that early life in my book.
Yeah, compellingly. Your dad became an FBI agent. Why did he become an FBI agent?
You know, I think this was during J. Edgar Hoover, and he just had a passion for the law. And he started working at the FBI while he was in Georgetown Law School, and then graduating with his degree in law, he went on to become a special agent. He tells some really interesting stories of his own about some of the cases he was involved in, but you know, he went on to have a varied career with doing a lot of other interesting things.
Did he talk to you about those cases? I mean, that was an interesting time in the Bureau. It was a very turbulent time in the country, late 50s, early 60s, you know, the whole red thing and then the civil rights movement and Hoover was right in the middle of all that. Did your dad get touch any of that?
He did. I mean, I was very young at the time when that was going on. So I at the time I wasn't hearing those stories, but later my dad would reminisce about some of his early days at the Bureau and what it was like working for J. Edgar Hoover. He traveled around, you know, being an FBI agent and had some big cases that he worked on. But he actually wrote a book about a thing called the Osage Indian Murders, which investigated people that were marrying into a tribe to get head rights and steal the land from Indians, which was a big case. But he tells some interesting stories that we probably could spend all day talking about. But
what was interesting to me is he left the FBI to go into public relations, which seems like a strange leap.
Total shift. And I don't know what motivated him. I think he was a little frustrated with the FBI, although, you know, I think he was proud to be an FBI agent and enjoyed part of that. But he studied journalism and in undergraduate, and he always had a hankering for writing. And I think the public relations, you know, getting involved in, you know, publishing magazines and trade publications, things like that, is what drew him into that change of careers.
Yeah, well, speaking of change of careers, when you were 10 years old, he made another and leaped into politics.
Yeah.
So was politics a big thing in your house? Were you surprised when you heard your dad was running for Congress?
Well, you know, I think he was dabbling because of his public relations background. He got involved in helping in a couple of campaigns, just not really in a high level, but I think helping in the managing of a couple of local campaigns, and then maybe helping in a gubernatorial campaign in Maryland for a Republican candidate that didn't have much of a chance. But he got interested and he attended a convention, and then he really was, he decided to run for Congress in a district that, you know, had no ability for a Republican to win in. And he decided to take on a long-term incumbent and ran once and with no money and no real chance, came very close and came back again and was elected to three terms in Congress and then gave up his seat to run for governor.
Why was he a Republican? You write that your family was a, you know, as many immigrant families were, was a strong, they were union people, strong Democratic family.
Yeah.
So
he may have been the first Republican in the family. I know that his dad was a strong Democrat and involved in the printers union. And I think my dad was initially really attracted to and enthralled with John F. Kennedy's
A lot of Irish Catholics were.
Yeah, at least Irish Catholic, it was almost a prerequisite, right?
Yeah.
But I think he, you know, he was attracted to at that time the philosophy of the Republican Party, and I think he just decided to have an interest in more of an interest in politics than he did before, and he ended up.
You wrote that that part of it was having been in the FBI and a kind of that was a big Law and Order time in 1966 when he made that decision. That became sort of a core of the Republican argument in 66 and 68.
Yeah, there's no question that was there's some parallels to some of the things that are going on today. But the Republican Party was talking about law and order, and I think coming from law enforcement background, maybe that was some of the things that motivated him.
Let me ask you about just as an aside, because I don't want to lose the thread of your story.
Yeah.
But just let's take it to.
Yeah, we could do an hour about my dad.
The president. I have a few more questions about him. The president, as you know, just sent these DHS agents into Portland, and he's talking about sending them into other cities. He did it without the assent of the governor or local authorities, and it is consonant with the campaign he's running for president, which is that there's this lawlessness going on, and he's kind of the thin blue line between disorder and stability. I wonder how you, as a governor, sort of react to what he's doing.
Well, it's I don't want to jump too far ahead in the conversation. From my dad's early FBI to what's happening today.
I'm completely absolving your dad of responsibility.
You skipped my whole life story.
Don't worry about it. I'm getting back to it, brother. It's too good to miss.
But yeah, so I talk actually to draw us back in and to bring it into the conversation. I talk about this in my book. That is kind of parallels with what's going on today in some respects. Right after I had become governor in 2015, we had
Freddie Gray,
the death of Freddie Gray, and some pretty bad violence and rioting going on in the streets.
So, we should just remind people what the Freddie Gray case was. He, if you want to do it.
Freddie Gray was a young man in the city of Baltimore who died in police custody. His death, much like some of the things that are happening today, set off frustration. This was after Ferguson. Baltimore was the next one. It was at the beginnings of the Black Lives Matter movement. And in addition to some peaceful protesting, we had some real violence break out in Baltimore City. And 400 in the first few hours, 400 businesses and homes were destroyed and burned, and 127 police and firefighters were injured. It was really out of control. And I, as a governor, had to make the decision to come in to help keep Baltimore safe and send in police officers and the Maryland National Guard. But we did so in a way that we allowed the protests to go on for a week, and we just backed up the city police who were beleaguered and overwhelmed.
You report that you had some tense discussions with the mayor at that time.
Yeah, we can talk a little bit about that in more detail if you want. But the parallel today is, I think, I'll tell you both sides of that story. I don't think that you should have to have federal troops or federal, whatever kind of federal
agents
are coming into these cities to take the actions that they're taking. But I also believe that we can't have sort of mobs with violence and destruction in some of our cities that have been, in some cases, in a couple of these cities, going on for several months at a time. And I would say that I actually talk about a better way to handle it. It was sort of a peace through strength, where we had the law enforcement able to protect property and life and limb and to keep people of the city safe and to stop the violent acts while protecting and allowing the peaceful protesters to express their very legitimate frustrations. So violence on either side is escalating the situation. And I think I write about that. I have five chapters about this in the,
yes,
in the book, about how to do it, I think, the right way. And we got credited for that. I taught a course at the National Governors Association on how to handle a crisis.
And
like
you
this.
Also walked the streets, which was important.
Very
you weren't
important.
A distant figure. But the question here really is, from the standpoint of governors and mayors, the pretext for sending these folks into these agents into Portland is that they're protecting federal buildings, but the local authorities there say they've actually inflamed the situation instead of helping.
Well, I think that's what you need to avoid. Yeah, and that's what we tried not to do. And if you look at our response in Baltimore, not only in 2015, but this time with the protests over the death of George Floyd, we responded better than most cities in America, where we had, you know, almost 10,000 people peacefully protesting and multiple protests, but for the most part, very nonviolent, very little destruction.
Yeah.
But we did have the state police and the National Guard backing up the city police to keep.
But they worked in concert,
Exactly. In a very reserved way that just allowed.
So I know you're a trained professional, so you're probably not that eager to weigh in on this, but just as the head of the Governors Association, would you have advised the White House not to send those agents in without the cooperation and coordination with local, state and local authority?
Well, it's not a decision I certainly would have made, but I also would have strongly advised those mayors and those cities and those governors to have taken more steps than they have to stop some of the violence and the destruction and the burning and the looting that's been going on for several months.
It seems like it's coordinated with the campaign that the president's running. He's running ads suggesting that if Joe Biden becomes elected president, that your personal safety will be at risk.
I can't speak to the motivations of the campaign or what they're thinking.
What about the message of the campaign?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the message is.
The message is be afraid, be very afraid if Biden gets
elected.
I
think the Democrats' message. I think they're making a mistake. I don't want to play pundit.
That's right.
This is more your expertise. You're more of a campaign guy than me. But I think the Democrats are making a mistake. With I've given him a platform to talk about you know, this, the whole defunding the police, and I realize Joe Biden is not in favor of defunding the police, but this message, when you see some anarchy in some of the streets of these cities and you have a talk about we have to get defund or get rid of police, it has opened the door for that. I'm not saying it should be the message, but it's certainly becoming an issue that they're going to both argue about from now until November.
Let's return to your story. We'll get back to current times. You went to Catholic school as well, DeMatha High School, a sports mecca. You must have been there right when Adrian Dantley was there, huh?
I was there with Adrian Dantley, and what a great
basketball players of all time.
He really was. He was leading scorer in the NBA, Rookie of the Year. You know, I was friends with Adrian. I just saw him not too long ago. He was a year older than me, but a great basketball player. I loved basketball, and you know, I wasn't quite good enough to make that team because they were the best team in the country, and I think had three NBA players on the team. And
that wasn't you, huh?
I wasn't one of them.
You also had there was a turbulence in your life around that time. Your parents got divorced. Your father came out. You were shooting baskets, and he came out and told you that your parents were gonna get divorced. It was shattering to your mom. She moved to Florida. You felt responsible and moved with her because you wanted to support her. I can't think of a more unsettling thing in the life of a teenage boy than to be ripped away from his friends, to be to be in that situation. What impact did that have on you?
Well, you know, I tell some of these stories just to tell you what made me the way I am, I guess.
Yeah.
Today.
But, so what effect did that have?
You know, I loved both my parents, and I admired my dad so much, and quite frankly, I enjoyed hanging out with him because we did really fun things together. I didn't want to leave my friends and the school that I loved, and have my life uprooted. But it's a tough thing. So many people go through these divorces, and it's hard on kids. I was a young teenager.
Yeah, I was one as well.
I really had a choice. Do I stay with my dad or stay with my mom? And I guess some people are put in that situation. And I made the decision that my mom just needed me more than my dad did. Even though I was a kid, I felt like I was there. I was her protector.
That's a tough position to be in.
Yeah. But it didn't turn out to be so bad. My mom trying to get away from Washington and get away from, just to find a new place to start over, moved us to Florida, and I ended up making all new friends and going to school, staying down there and going to school at Florida State, and came back to the Maryland area, the Washington area, after college. But I put together
because your dad didn't think selling suntan lotion was a career for you.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it while I was there, but I guess he was probably right. It wasn't something I could do long term.
First of all, your dad. I remember your dad because I was a kid. We're about the same age, and I was watching the Watergate.
You look much younger,
hearings.
Though.
But, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the camera is what it is. But But your dad was one of only six Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee to vote to impeach Richard Nixon. In fact, I think he's the only one who voted for all the counts against Nixon. He was running for governor of Maryland in a Republican primary, and he voted to impeach a Republican president. That is an extraordinary thing.
Well, it's I talk about this a little bit in my book. It had a huge impact on me to this day. I learned so much about integrity and public service from my dad, especially that one moment in time when he was on the House Judiciary Committee for that vote. He was the very first Republican to come out for Nixon's impeachment. And it rippled across the rest of the committee and across the country, public opinion, Nixon's decisions about what to do. At the time, it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. And for decades, it hurt him personally, politically.
He lost that primary and he would have won.
He had a really good chance to be elected. And the Republicans were really angry. They saw him as a turncoat, or why aren't you supporting the president of your own party, and how could you do this? later, of course, it's the thing he's most remembered for. And the thing, you know, his the one thing in life that I think people say, wow, your dad had a lot of courage and he stood up and took this stand. But at the time he knew ahead of time this was going to he was going to lose friends in Congress.
Did he tell you that? Did he talk to you?
Oh, yeah. He said, you know, this may be the end of my political career. A lot of people are going to be upset. And it was true. I mean, the people in Congress stopped talking to him. He got, I think, we didn't have the internet back then and you didn't have Twitter, but he got, you know, 15,000 pieces of hate mail. You know, people mailed feces in the mail to his congressional office. It took a long time, but later, of course, he turned out to be, you know, Nixon. He actually was a Nixon supporter. He campaigned with Nixon. He thought Nixon had done a good job on foreign policy with China. But as that FBI agent and that Georgetown trained lawyer, as he fought to make sure it was a fair trial and that Nixon could cross-examine witnesses and present evidence, because he did not let it become a partisan process. But when he saw the evidence, he gave a very impassioned plea that the president was guilty of impeachable offenses and that no man was above the law.
Yeah. No, his speech was quite a speech. I was curious when I was reading this whether he had conversations with friends in the FBI during that period.
You know, that's a great question. I never asked him that. He didn't really talk about it. I think probably not, because he saw his role as a juror.
Yeah, right.
Sitting in judgment of the president of the United States and one of the most important decisions to face the country. And he wasn't really sharing much of the information or the evidence. He was keeping it, he was trying to really wrestle with this, making sure he made the right decision.
You know, John F. Kennedy wrote a book called Profiles in Courage, and it was all about these kinds of decisions where people made a choice between what they thought was their duty and their political self-interest. And you know, so many people say today, and you hear it all the time, I'm sure, as someone who is viewed as an apostate in the Trump world, people saying, well, why don't people split with the president? How could they tolerate this? How could they? And the answer is, you know, they're worried about their political careers.
Right. Well, and this was, Nixon was seen as a guy that kind of went after, he had these enemies list, and he was very aggressive if you weren't, you know, toeing the line and being on, but, you know, people
not a gentle soul like Donald Trump.
We knew he wouldn't exactly. But I mean, I've been one of the few people that's willing to. I haven't been out, you know, going after the president for no reason. But when I believe he's doing something wrong, I've been one of the few Republicans that'll stand up and say so. But there are a lot of folks that really are. They're afraid of, you know, being tweeted about or being attacked or being primaried, or
they would say, although you always have the threat of a primary, but they would say, well, that's great for you because you're from Maryland, which is an overwhelmingly Democratic state, so you have the leeway to speak your mind.
They do say that sometimes. They say, I agree with what you're saying, but you can say it, I can't.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
How did you feel when your father lost that primary for governor? You had experienced his loss in the first place, but you expected him to lose in 66 or whenever it was.
I think he was really shocked by it, because there were polls showing him winning the general election. Mm-hmm. It was a tiny turnout because there aren't many Republicans in Maryland to begin with, and not today, and there weren't certainly any back then either. It was a tiny turnout, and the few people that came out were really angry with him and, you know, supporting President Nixon. So after the election, you know, it all kind of changed, but it was a little bit of a shock. I mean, nobody expected him to lose.
Did it leave a sour taste in your mouth about politics?
You know, I always had kind of a love-hate relationship with politics. I was fascinated
to this day.
Yeah, to this day. I mean, I'm probably more frustrated and disgusted with it than I ever have been, frankly. But I've enjoyed the campaign aspect of it, and I learned an awful lot. But my dad gave me some really good advice, and he said, "Don't make it your career." So I spent most of my life as a small businessman in the private sector, but I dabbled in politics because I thought it was important. And so,
yeah, you didn't just dabble. You ran in 1992 against a guy named Steny Hoyer.
Yeah, we had a fun time. Steny and I are close, friends now, but we had a pretty aggressive campaign. I ran a underfunded campaign in a 3-1 Democratic district in a big presidential year when Bill Clinton was winning in a landslide in my district, and we gave him a run for his money.
Yeah, you won 4 of 5 counties.
Yeah, 4 out of 5.
Just not the biggest one.
not the one that counted.
Yeah. But when that was over, did you say, okay, I got that out of my system, I'm probably not going to do this again?
Yeah, no, I was done. I really had no interest in running ever again. And it took me 22 years to do it again.
And you did do it again. You had been successful in business. You emerged as a kind of fiscal hawk in the state and rode that to the governorship, and you won. Just getting back to your dad for a second, and the reason I keep asking these questions is I am totally fascinated by fathers and sons in politics.
Yeah, no,
I work for Rich Daley in Chicago. I work for Adlai Stevenson III, and I've had conversations like these with Mitt Romney and others.
Yeah,
and it's such a complicated thing. Because
you should explain it to him. I'm proud of him.
No, I understand,
but so much.
But not that part. Every single person would say how much they admire their dads, and every single person you could point to elements of them that you can see the lineage in them. But there's also you scaled a political height that your dad tried to scale and didn't. And
well, I'll tell you an interesting story. When I, my dad was in his 80s when I got elected. And on election night, when we had pulled off the impossible, and no, I was not on anybody's radar screen, and we underfunded campaign. We won in Maryland, which no one was expecting. It was the biggest surprise upset in America in 2014. My dad was there with us, and I turned to him. He had run unsuccessfully in 1974. In 2014, I won, and I turned to him and I said, "Dad, it may have taken us 40 years, but we're finally going to have a Larry Hogan in the governor's mansion." Tears rolled down my dad's face, and
yeah,
I was at that point when I realized that, I'd been proud of him my whole life, but that night he was pretty proud of me.
Yeah, did you? That must have meant a lot to you.
It did. Yeah.
I mean, we all kind of like seek the approval.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, so I went into business and was very successful. He spent most of his life, in politics, and I was able to kind of carve out my own niche. But that politics was still, even after 20 years of kind of trying to go cold turkey, it dragged me back in because I just got frustrated with what was going on in our state, and I decided maybe I can try to do something about it. And I put together a grassroots citizen organization that had just as many Democrats and independents as Republicans. It's the only way to win. And we had the highest Democratic registration in America. Republican candidates don't win very often.
No, there's no doubt that was defying the laws, the political laws of gravity. I meant to ask you about one element of your biography, your early biography, when your dad rescued you from the suntan lotion business.
I would say, stole me away from that great job, but
you got you look like a guy who could easily burn.
That's true. I even had skin cancer issues and all that.
You got a job in Congress with a fellow named John Ruslo. I remember him well. He was about as right-wing a guy as a former Western director of the John Birch Society and so on. And, here you are sort of viewed as the quintessential moderate Republican now.
Yeah.
And I assume you were inclined that way then.
It was simple as this. I graduated from college. I was looking for a job. I sent my resumes. I graduated with a degree in political science from Florida State University and put resumes out all over the Hill. And he was the only one that offered me a job. It was a Republican congressman. I think I was making $11,000 a year. You know, it didn't, you know, it wasn't anything about my burning desire to be supportive of John Ruzulo, but it was my first, you know, experience on the Hill and didn't last very long. I didn't really enjoy being a Hill staffer. It was, I think I was there less than a year. And, but it, that was my experience on Capitol Hill.
Was there anything about the way he handled his issues that caused you as a young man to say, geez, that's a little...
I was so young. I was a kid coming out. My moonlighting job was helping to run my dad's campaign for county executive. He was reviving his career.
Which he won.
We won that race. Another kind of upset. So I wasn't paying that much attention. I was going there doing my job, responding to constituent, concerns and then going and doing the fun stuff, running campaign.
And your dad... you wanted to go to work for your dad. Your dad was hesitant, and your dad said, "Okay, you can come to work for me as long as you're the lowest paid member of the staff."
Right. So you know, I wanted to really get this experience, and I loved being a part of being back in touch with my dad and getting a chance to learn. And I really was a big part of his campaign to get him elected. And everybody on the team was like, "Let's go! Now we're going to go take over this county government, and we're going to get all these things done." And my dad said, "Well, you're not coming because it'll be nepotism, and I'll get criticized and blamed." And I'm saying, "But you know, what if I work for free?"
It is a little obvious when your name is Larry Hogan Jr. and the guy in charge is Larry Hogan Sr. It's hard.
So
to
I said,
hide.
What if I just work for free? No, we'll still be criticized. But a number of the other folks that were coming in the administration were like, "Hey, we'll get over that because he's really valuable." My dad said, and they said, he can't work for free and have these responsibilities. So they put me at the lowest possible level of any county employee. And I didn't care what they were paying me. It was a great experience. And I worked hard doing multiple different jobs.
You didn't get married until quite late in life,
right?
Or later than usual. I wonder, when I was reading about, your parents' breakup, whether that was were you shy about the experience of it?
You know? I mentioned that, but probably had some impact. I mean, I waited until after I was 40. I was, to actually, I joked that I didn't settle down for the first girl that came along or the second, but I took my time. But I think, my parents' divorce did have a big impact on me. And I was like, I don't ever want to go through that or hurt somebody the way I saw my mom hurt. But part of it was, I just really enjoyed being single, and I had lots of relationships, and I was really focused on growing my business. And I never realized how late it was getting. I was in my 30s, and I was like, hey, who cares? And then I got over 40, and I was like, maybe I should, I'm a young 40, but maybe I've got to settle down.
So tell me about your wife, Yumi.
Yeah, so I met this incredible woman who was born in South Korea, who immigrated to the country, became a citizen here, and came over young and married a Korean American here, and had three daughters who she basically raised on her own as a single mom, coming here to learn the language and do multiple jobs while raising three kids. Incredibly difficult story. But I met her. She's an artist.
Yes.
She's now an art professor. There was something really different about her. She was very special. She's beautiful on the outside and the inside. And she was so different than me. I was very outgoing and knew a lot of people and was involved in a lot of things. And she was a quiet, they say opposites attract. But there was something calming about her. And we just connected. And we had a little difficulty communicating at first. Because my Korean was non-existent and her English was struggling.
Do you speak Korean now? Did you pick up some of it?
So I'm really good on all the food, and I know all of
those.
There's
a theme growing up here, Gov.
Yeah. Hey, so I'll tell you a quick story. I went to the White House for the first time with President Obama, with my wife, for the governor's dinner, and I was so impressed with this. We walked through the receiving line to shake the president's hand with the first lady, the president, take the picture. And he says, "Annyeonghaseyo," which means, how do you say hello? in Korean. And I was really impressed that, number one, he knew that my wife was Korean, and number two, he knew how to say hello in Korean. So I was sitting with Valerie Jarrett, and I was like, I was so impressed. He knew that. And she said, well, he does his homework before they kind of prepare him for those things. I know a little Korean, but certainly not enough to communicate. But my wife's been a big part of my success. And I talk a lot about that in the book.
You do.
Especially when I went through my battle with cancer. I mean,
yeah, which I want to get to in a second. I just want to ask you this. She is an immigrant. She became a citizen in 1994. You're, as you said at the outset, you know, and as most of us are, you're the descendant of immigrants. How do you interpret the president's approach to immigration and this sort of weaponization of fear of immigration in our politics? Is that a personal issue to you?
Well, I just recently raised this issue. I talk a little bit, one story about this that,
yes,
in the book that bothered, a recent story, where the president was really insulting to Koreans.
And your wife was deeply offended.
She was deeply offended. And we actually sat with the vice president at the White House dinner the next night, and she raised it to him and said, I know your dad fought for freedom in South Korea, and they've talked about it before. And she told him how the president had insulted her the night before and how hurt she was by it. She was almost in tears.
Wait a second, you can't leave the story there and not say how he dealt with it.
Yeah, I'm not going to speak for him, but I mean, I think, you know, we expressed the frustration, and the president that night again at the White House reiterated the same kinds of comments he made the night before, and there's no reason for it. But look, I think she
wanted to get up and leave, but she was too polite.
She wanted to get up and leave twice, once at the Republican Governors Association and then again at the White House dinner. But we stayed out of, you know, respect for, you know, the people that we were with and this respect for the office. But, I don't know why he says the things he does or the way he talks.
You know why he does it. He thinks there's political profit.
I don't think it makes sense for him politically. If you do these things to help you politically, I think it's a miscalculation, because I think shrinking the base and alienating, groups of people is not the way to go about being successful. Here in my case, in Maryland, we've reached out to, I won the Asian vote overwhelmingly. I have a 70% approval among Black voters. I do extremely well with Democrats and independents and suburban women. And if Republicans are gonna be successful, if the president is gonna be successful, or other Republicans, they're gonna have to find a way to not alienate each of those groups. And so the doubling down on the base, I don't think is a good strategy. And it may help the president. It's going to crush a lot of down ballot folks.
Did the invocation of Kung Flu sound to you like a guy who was taking it in a different direction?
Yeah, it sure did. I thought that was uncalled for.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
You talk about your cancer. You, the Freddie Gray crisis was one of the first things you confronted as governor. And then almost hard on its heels came this personal disaster. Talk about that. You describe it vividly in the book. Talk about your battle with cancer.
Yeah, it was. So I had only been governor for 5 months. It was 60 days after dealing with the disturbance in Baltimore. And after my first legislative session, after having just won this big election and just put our team together, we were off to a good start trying to make a difference in our state. And I was on our first trade mission to Asia when I started having some aches and pains. I was feeling a little run down. And then I had a lump pop out of my throat. And I said, I've got to check this out when I get back. So I wasn't thinking there was anything seriously wrong, and I went, three doctors walked into a room and told me I had very aggressive and advanced, potentially life-threatening cancer, that I had 50-some tumors from my neck to my groin.
Were you alone? Was your wife with you at the time?
I was alone in the room, I just kind of swallowed hard and maybe blinked my eyes. I was a little bit stunned. I wasn't really scared or it was a little bit just shocking. But my first thought was, how do I tell my wife and my kids? It was Father's Day weekend. It was Friday of Father's Day weekend. And, I had to go home and tell them. And I was more worried about, being positive for them than I really was about myself, frankly. Sounds strange, but it was true. And it was talked about my dad earlier. He was coming over for dinner. And I had to tell my dad, who took it even tougher than my wife and my daughters. Even though I was 59 at the time, and my dad, thought of me as his little boy that he couldn't help, keep safe. But it was a tough battle. After I shared it with my family and my staff, I went out and told the 6 million people of Maryland who had just put their trust in me to run their state. And I tried to be as transparent and open as possible.
You went out there and did a press conference against doctors' orders, didn't you?
Yeah. So on Monday morning, I had to go in for surgery to remove a lymph node from under my arm. They put me under full anesthesia and then gave me serious, I think, Percocet or Vicodin or something afterwards for pain. And doctor said, just take off the rest of the afternoon, get some rest. Don't make any major decisions. Don't drive or operate any heavy machinery. And I was like, the state troopers don't let me drive and I'm not operating any machinery, but I am going to give a press conference this afternoon. And he said, oh no, you can't possibly do a press conference. And I said, well, I'm going to go into the hospital on, this Friday to start 24-hour day chemotherapy. I want to tell people before what's going on, before the rumors start. I want to be as open as possible. And he said, they're not going to ask you questions at this press conference, are they? And I said, I'm pretty sure they're going to ask me questions. So I kind of went out there. It was a little bit like truth serum, I guess. I just felt very relaxed and shared it with them.
Media would love to have everybody take Percocet before they give their press conferences.
It would make for good television.
Yes, it would. So you went through this chemo. You were working while you were doing it, actually working while you were going through at the very moment you were going through chemo, but you wrote that there was a time when you were getting all these expressions of prayers and support from people. There was a time when it suddenly overcame you.
I was trying to be really strong, and maybe I was internalizing some of this. I mentioned when I first got the word, I was thinking about my family. Then I thought about how am I going to tell my staff and my cabinet, and then how am I going to tell the rest of the people in Maryland? And then let's get a plan. What are we going to do? I'm going to get this 24-hour a day chemo. I'm going to go through this hospital. How am I going to? I was just very focused, like normal. Let's just get this done. Very businesslike. And I never really focused on the fact that I might actually not survive this until one night I was taking these 24-hour steroid drugs along with the chemo, and I couldn't sleep. And I was laying in a hospital bed late at night all by myself, and I was reading these cards and letters that my staff had brought, a sample of people that were little kids that were, saying they were praying for me, and just wonderful expressions of support. And all of a sudden it hit me. Not only was I choking up a little bit about the sentiment that these people were expressing, but it hit me that if all these people are that worried, maybe there's a real threat here. And I finally broke down. It was like, I guess my guard was down. Maybe it was the drugs or whatever, but it finally hit me. And, and I had a, I actually started crying in the hospital bed there. But it was up until then, I was like, never, once got, I wasn't scared. I wasn't, upset. And then it finally caught up. But then I got right back on track, and stayed focused and stayed positive. I worked the whole time in the hospital and tried to keep everybody else positive. And I met so many incredible fellow patients that were going through much tougher struggles, met their families. I walked the halls of the hospital and met some of the kids in the pediatric oncology ward. And, it sounds crazy to say this, but it was actually an experience that I think, really shaped me. And
I want to ask you about that in a second, but you took some young, after that you started hosting young cancer patients, children at your, in the governor's box at Camden Yards and at other sporting events. And you write about a young man named Andrew who gave you a list of what you should know about cancer. It's okay to cry. It's okay to find a hugging person. And you kept that list on your desk. And what happened to Andrew?
So Andrew is doing really well. Andrew Oberle, he was 5 years old when I first met him. I guess he's 10 now because I just hit my 5-year anniversary. But we went to, this was at the team formerly known as the Redskins that we don't talk about. This it was at the Washington football team.
We call them
team.
The Washington Gridlock now.
Yeah, that's a great name. The Washington Gridlocks. I like that one. And so, you know, we went down on the field and met the players and they signed autographs for the kids. And it was really wonderful. We had a, it was a group called, you know, it was a, maybe we had a dozen cancer kids. We went up to the suite and this little kid, Andrew, he handed me this note. He said, "Governor, my mommy told me that you're going to go through chemo and you're going to be in the hospital. And I, she helped me write this note." He had this list of, you know, all, you just mentioned a couple of them. One of them was make sure they give you the num-num cream before they give you the pokey. So apparently before they give you the shots, they wrote.
That seems like good advice.
So that's pretty good advice. So I go to the doctor and say, "Hey, where's the num-num cream? You guys just keep sticking me." But when I did my press conference that I was, you know, healthy and had become cancer-free, this little kid comes running up. I didn't really know he was going to be at this press conference. He ran up to the podium while I'm talking and just hugged around my legs. And I was there when he, you know, he rang the bell when he was cancer-free. We sent notes back and forth, but he's just one of the many people that I just had this connection with. I still pick up the phone constantly and I'm calling people. Somebody will say, "I have this friend or I have this family member that's in the hospital. They're going through this." And I'll pick up the phone and call them and say, "Let me share my experience and what can I do to, you know, help you go through it."
So I know you've discussed this and you with Vice President Biden, who and your reference there to what you're doing for others is reminiscent of his relationship with people around the country, because he's become someone who's who people turn to for solace when they're fighting these things. Has this been something of a bond between you guys? Have you developed a friendship around cancer?
So he and I get along, you know, really well. And while he was vice president, we had a good relationship. And you know, I think he's, you know, he's got a very engaging personality and was always very you know, friendly. I haven't seen him since Elijah Cummings' funeral, where mm-hmm. we got a chance to talk a little bit. But yeah, we've always had a very friendly. He's a very affable guy.
Yeah, I know him well.
Yeah, I know you do.
You wrote your father's name in for president in 2016. Could you see yourself voting for Biden in the fall?
Look, I you know, I don't want to try to dodge the issue, but I really
yes, you do.
But I do want to dodge it. You know, a lot of people in America, you know, this is a tough election we have coming up here in November, and frankly, you know, I'm a little bit frustrated with both parties and where we are today with our divisive politics, and you know, regardless of what happens in November, I think, you know, both parties are going to re-examine, you know, where we're going to head in the future.
Someone is going to be president, though.
Presumably,
if you didn't vote for Trump in 2016, I presume you're not going to vote for him in 2020.
Well, it's not going to have much of an impact in my state. You know, Hillary won by almost 30 points in Maryland, and I imagine Biden will as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm not going to plow this any further.
Thank you.
Because you're like I said, a trained professional on the cancer issue. You had this song that was in your earbuds all the time, a Tim McGraw song called "Live Like You Were Dying," and some of the lyrics are, "And I loved deeper and I spoke sweeter and I gave forgiveness I'd been denying. Someday I hope you get the chance to have to live life like you were dying." And has it changed the way you live life?
You know, that song had a, you know, I'm a country music fan to begin with, and I like Tim McGraw. But right after I got that diagnosis from the doctors, you know, and I was on my way home to figure out how am I gonna explain this to my wife and my daughters, I put the earbuds in, I listen to that song because it's kind of a hopeful message about making the most out of every day you have. And fast forward 6 months later, as I'm, 5 or 6 months later, as I'm in the worst part of my chemo, the University of Maryland Medical Center, where I was being treated, has a benefit concert for the Children's Hospital, and Tim McGraw is the headliner, and they asked me to come and introduce Tim McGraw, and so I got a chance to meet him backstage. I had never met him before, and I went, I said to him backstage, Tim, I just want you to know how much your song inspired me, and we got a chance to talk, and he said, a lot of people, it's not my biggest song, but a lot of people really feel a connection. He told me about his dad, Tug McGraw, who's a baseball player.
I grew up rooting for him in New York City.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So he said that every time he sings the song, he thinks about his dad. And, so I went out and introduced him on the stage. He gave a great concert. And then he came out and sang the song and dedicated it to me in front of all the people. I didn't know he was going to do that. He said, this goes out to Governor Hogan. He's going through a
tough
battle. I was crying. Yeah. The audience was singing, and then afterwards, his manager. I was running out, the door, not really feeling bad. By the way, I was at the worst part of my chemo. I could barely stand, and head was swollen. No eyebrows or eyelashes, mm-hmm. and really sick. They gave me a guitar from that he had signed. It said, "To Governor Hogan, live like you're dying," and I have it hanging on the wall of my office. It's one of my cherished possessions.
I'm sure it is. But what does that mean to you, live like you're dying? Because we all are, and it strikes me, and frankly, we've all been made more aware of our mortality in the last 4 months. Life is a gift, and you don't know how long it lasts.
I think I take every day as precious. And the song, to me, it was so inspirational. Why it was my theme song is because it really, I'm going to give this job I've got as governor everything I've got every single day that I'm given. Every day is a bonus as far as I'm concerned. I wasn't sure I was going to be here. Makes me realize what are really the important things in life and what are the things that are not as important. And it really does make you think. If you take each and every day and say, you don't know if it's going to be your last, and you live that way and you make the most out of it, I think it can have a major impact on your life.
Let's talk about this this siege that we've been that we're still going through here. We've seen this resurgence of COVID, even in your own state, and you've done a good job there. There's been an uptick in the last few days in cases. Is this out of control right now?
It certainly appears we're not out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. This is I'm concerned that it's going to get worse. It may get worse than it was before. The fall, as we head into the flu season, could be really serious problems all across the country. We've been so far luckier than many other states. We have a slight uptick in cases because we've tripled our testing recently, so the numbers go up, but our positivity rate is still declining, and our ICU's beds are declining, and so compared to a lot of states, we're doing okay, but we're watching it every single day because we're not immune. I mean, the states all around us are starting to blow up, and we've taken some very early and aggressive steps, but that doesn't mean it can't flare back up again.
You've expressed frustration periodically about the federal handling of the crisis. What should have been done from the beginning that would have made a difference now?
I think early on, the first few months, while the president was downplaying, saying it wasn't a big deal, that it was going to go away, it was going to disappear. It was 15 people, soon it would be none, and that we didn't develop a national testing strategy. And there were people in the administration, some of our public health officials, folks that were on top of it and raising the alarms, and they were telling the governors to get ready. But the governors were sort of on their own. It was a 50-state strategy, and we were scrounging around for things.
In fact, the president said that it was up to the states.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think you know, we've been fighting ever since to catch up from those first few months of being behind as the virus got out of control.
The White House sent a proposal to the Hill for extended relief, stimulus and relief, but it included cuts in funding for testing, for tracing, for the CDC. Why in the world would that be?
Oh, it's a terrible idea. I spoke out very strongly about it. We're probably going to talk about that with all the governors today. The most important thing we can do to get this virus under control right now is more testing and more contact tracing so we can identify where the cases are and try to stop the spread. And we need more money for testing and not less money for testing. So I have no idea where that motivation comes from.
Governor, I know you have to run. You've said that you want to be part of building the Republican Party in the post-Trump era. And you said earlier what you thought the Republican Party needs to do in terms of broadening its base. But the Trump base is a big part of the Republican constituency. And do you have any reason to believe that whenever Trump leaves, he's actually going to go? Or is he going to lead his faction forward? And doesn't that create problems for people like you who would like to see the Republican Party take a different direction?
Well, I guess time will tell. And I think we'll probably figure that out sometime after this November election. But certainly there's a big chunk of the Republican base that's very strongly supportive of President Trump. But I think there's also a large chunk of folks in America that that really are kind of frustrated with where the Republican Party is and that may be looking for a different direction. And we're going to have that conversation.
Do you see yourself potentially as a candidate for president in 2024? Your job is over in 2022, the beginning of 2023. It gives you plenty of time to run.
Well, it gives me plenty of time to keep doing this job till January of 2023. But yeah, I think it's too early. I want to get past this election, get past the virus, and then we'll take a close look at it. I really, this writing this book and is not about actually running for anything. I really, honestly, am not so concerned about my future in the Republican Party. I'm more concerned that we have a future for the Republican Party, because I really strongly believe in the two-party system, and I think we've got a lot of work to do.
Governor, good to be with you. The book is still standing. Governor Larry Hogan.
Thank you very much.
Great to be with you. Hope it's the first of many conversations.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Samantha Neal, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Megan Marcus, and Ashley Lusk. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.